Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome and happy Friday, everyone. It's the Three Martini Lunch along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim is also the author of The Weed Agency, due out June 3rd. You can pre-order your copies already. We have Good, Bad, and Crazy Martinis to close out the work week here. We start with the good, and it's jumping off from where we were yesterday in the Good Martini, and the New York Times enjoying, well, we're at least enjoying, their latest episode of Very Public Hypocrisy, as it turns out that Jill Abramson was fired for demanding the same pay that her predecessor got as managing editor of the New York Times. We had a lot of fun with Arthur Sulzberger Jr., a.k.a. Pinch, yesterday, and he came out with a statement shortly after we recorded talking about there is not a significant difference in the salary last year for Jill Abramson as opposed to the final year of her predecessor's salary. Jim, you go through the numbers on CampaignSpot. Turns out there's still pretty big discrepancy, and even when she had lesser positions at the New York Times, males of the same position seem to be making quite a bit more than her. And so the more Sulzberger tries to dig in his heels here, the more this story just keeps looking better and better for people who are tired of the New York Times preaching at us.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a fourth generation inheritor of a giant fortune and your nickname is Pinch, maybe we shouldn't be stunned that you kind of coasted through some of the math classes. And the idea of what numbers big, greater than and less than might be a little fuzzy on that. And you know, here's the thing. When they say, you know, directly comparable, let's keep in mind, any two numbers are directly comparable. You know, one in a million, you can compare them. One is a million times bigger. You know, a million is a million times bigger than the number one. We actually finally got some numbers from Ken Auletta over the New Yorker. And so 2011, Abramson started out with $475,000. Now, most people are like, oh, my goodness, that's nearly $500,000. That's a lot. That's great. What's she complaining about? Well, her predecessor was making $559,000. So basically, she was making, you know, 84% of what her predecessor made. Now, maybe that most people would say, oh, you know, it's close enough. She's just starting out. They can raise it later. You know, that there's you could argue it's justifiable. But remember, it's not that, you know, the president and the Democrats and the, you know, war on women rhetoric is all about comparable pay. They want equal pay, by golly. So it goes up to 503, and then she complains later. It gets up to 525. But the short version is that she never made what her predecessor made. Highest percentage-wise she ever made was about 93%. Is that comparable? I think there are probably a lot of men who'd say, eh, close enough. And there are probably a lot of women who'd say, heck no, it's not comparable. But then you find out other positions, like when she was Washington bureau chief, she was making 100,000 less than her predecessor. So that's not broadly comparable. And so a whole bunch of folks would say, one, I think everyone in America who bothered to pay attention to this last night said, man, I am underpaid. Because really, you know, there's a joke here. You don't really go into journalism to make a lot of money. The vast majority of the journalism world is toiling away in the five-figure range. To be making 500 grand a year or even 400 grand a year is a lot of money in journalism. So the first is there might be a limited sympathy about how terribly everyone's being mistreated here. But then the next thing is that if, you know, Pinch saying, ah, they're comparable, I think there are a lot of people who might say, no, they're not really that comparable, that there is a big difference compared to her predecessors, and that maybe she's got a legitimate beef here. I guess the bigger deal is that the New York Times has been beating the drum on this relentlessly and, you know, going after Republicans, I mean, you know, basically holding everybody else to an extremely high standard. And then when they themselves, the numbers come out, it's pretty clear that they're paying their women less than they were paying the man. They basically believe this is not a big deal and everyone should move on from this. And this is, you know, a distraction and all that stuff. And who are we to meddle in, you know, their decisions of who they pay and how much, which is how every other company feels about the New York Times and the way they cover these issues with, you know, how they do that, how they pay their employees.
Yeah, that's the best part of this story from the conservative perspective. And you had down in your Morning Jolt point today is that at some point people see that this is kind of perhaps how adults run the world, not the liberal kindergarten version of the way that things should work, according to the New York Times. And the question is, will they actually learn their lesson from this? And the answer is probably not.
No. And like, it's worth noting from this. I think at some point it'd be good for conservatives to get down and actually kind of discuss. Well, one, would it be better if the world had more openness about salaries? And I think everybody's kind of back and forth, not sure, because everybody kind of wants to know how much everybody else is making. But everyone might be kind of self-conscious about how much they're making. Am I overpaid compared to my peers? Am I underpaid compared to my peers? You know, there was an interesting article in Vox by a writer who said, look, you know, It's ridiculous. This is all done in secrecy. This is how people end up getting bad deals from their employers. They don't know how much to ask for. They don't know when they deserve a raise. They don't know when they're underpaid. By golly, it's time for a lot more openness in these matters. Nowhere on Vox could I find the listings of the salaries of Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias and the author of this piece and all that stuff. So it's openness once again for everybody else, and you go first, and then they'll talk salaries.
I was scared there for a minute. When you said there's an interesting article on Vox, I was getting a little scared, but you you rescued yourself well.
It's only the hypocrisy that makes it interesting. By the way, I just want to point out also yesterday, middle of the day, Ezra Klein comes out with a piece that's headlined, "Be careful what you believe about the Times and Jill Abramson right now." And you just got to say, it's mommy and daddy are fighting. that basically, look, we love Jill Abramson, but we also love the Times. Nobody's bad here. We're all liberal progressives. Everyone stop fighting. I think instead it's going to be, look, you know, Abramson may have a very legitimate gripe, and the Times may have a perfectly legitimate case to say, look, it's nobody's business what we choose to pay our senior employees. But that's not what they said for anybody else ever. So it's, you know, getting hoist on their own petard here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, on to the bad martini now. And one of the emerging scandals and tragedies in America are these wait lists that are now at 7 different veterans hospitals at least. And in his testimony yesterday on Capitol Hill, Veterans Affairs Secretary and retired General Eric Shinseki pretty much hinted that there could very well be a whole lot more that this happens at. In his testimony on the Senate side of Capitol Hill yesterday, you could just understand in the sheer passion and ferocity of his statement that Eric Shinseki finds all of this intolerable.
Any allegation, any adverse incident like this makes me mad as hell. I could use stronger language here, Mr. Chairman, but in deference to the committee, I won't.
Calm down, Mr. Secretary. Calm down.
I've just been told that Ben Stein told him to show a little more emotion in his voice as he did that. Usually I try, I have all kinds of, you know, snarky one-liners, but I really don't have much here. It's just so abominable that the Department of Veterans Affairs could basically just have people wait for treatment. Everybody kind of knows that they had life-threatening conditions and were just told to wait, and then kind of covered it up and then basically created, you know, two sets of books. It just sounds about as terrible as you could possibly imagine. Is Shinseki really mad as hell? Well, we can question by the tone of his voice. Well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he is. Well, nobody's been fired yet. They say they're still conducting their investigation. They'll get back to us. I seem to remember that from GM. I remember that from Acorn. I remember that from everybody else. It's, you know, I remember that from the IRS. I remember that from the NSA. I remember that from the State Department and Benghazi. This is the very predictable playbook. Let's not rush to judgment. You know what? Life is short. Let's get there a little quicker, okay? And the next question is, you know, he gets talking about isolated incidents. Well, they're in like 10 states, okay? So at that point, when does it stop being isolated incidents and it starts being a culture of the place, a kind of place in which everybody kind of believes this is how you can operate because nobody above you is going to object and nobody below you is going to blow the whistle on this. He says he's going to take responsibility. Okay, what does that mean? He's also adamant he shouldn't resign. And, you know, look, if you have a colossal failure that gets veterans killed because they literally die waiting for treatment, the idea that he hasn't thought about it is kind of appalling. And the idea that he thinks this is ridiculous, and apparently Bernie Sanders, the socialist from Vermont, said he thought he'd been doing a pretty good job. And I'd really just love to know what it would require for Bernie Sanders to think he's not doing a good job. Being the drama and the lack of accountability in this administration, really kind of intriguing, though, is there are a lot of people who are saying that, look, the public kind of tunes out the IRS, the public kind of tunes out Benghazi. The public will not tune out failure to give veterans the care that they need and the care that they deserve. And so this may actually be kind of a late-in-the-cycle bombshell. There are a whole bunch of Democrats on Capitol Hill indicating that they're not willing to be like Sanders and stick by Shinseki, and that you may see a bipartisan denunciation of the administration on this. And so the question is, is it just Shinseki who falls on his sword, or is there a sense that this is a broader issue within the administration of a lack of, you know, making very bold pledges, but then not living up to them?
All right, on to the third martini now. And after such a sobering story like that, Jim, it's important to end the week on something that really can take you into the weekend with a smile on your face. Lots of folks have seen this on social media. I believe it was on Wednesday evening. There was an Idaho Republican governor's debate. There are 4 candidates in the primary, even though the incumbent, Butch Otter, is a Republican. He's running again. He is running against State Senator Russ Fulcher, who is the chairman of the GOP caucus. Then there are the 2 others. There is Walt Bayes, who is a relatively elderly gentleman who is very passionate about homeschooling. And then there is Harley Brown, who is a biker and proudly declares himself non-politically correct. Here's four different clips from this debate. The first and the last are from Mr. Brown. The two in the middle are from Mr. Bayes. Enjoy.
I don't like political correctness. Can I say this? It sucks. It's bondage. And I'm about as politically correct as your proverbial turd in a punch bowl.
The television would talk to me for 30 minutes or an hour. And, well, what would you do if they came out to take your kids? Well, I'd shoot them. What else would you do? I can stand up where these guys are falling down. I don't know how to put it, but how many of them have been in jail for what they believe?
And you have your choice, folks. A cowboy, a curmudgeon, a biker, or a normal guy. Take your pick. Thank you very much. We're leaving it up to you.
Jim, I don't know how many of these folks will end up on the stage for the 2016 presidential debate, but it would definitely not be dull.
I had said that actually I proposed to Reince Priebus that every 2014 Republican presidential debate must require one biker grandpa on stage. Just periodically offer something, slogans such as, the punch bowl of Idaho needs a turd, and I am that turd, or something like that. I go back and forth on whether these kind of gadfly candidates or you know, lucky if they hit 2% candidates should be up on stage. I think yesterday or earlier in the week, Idaho made a good case that, you know what, invite them to the first one. Just bring them on to see. It's kind of a weirdness, funniness. It is the American people on parade. And somebody had noted, you know, it says something about Idaho that the vanilla boring guy on stage is named Butch Otter. And he's the incumbent. And this is, by the way, I think a deliberate strategy that if you're the incumbent, you might be in trouble, then you want to split the anti-incumbent vote as much as possible. Let's bring everybody up on stage and see what they can do. Let's turn this into a circus and nobody's all that upset about the job I've been doing. I guess it's good that they had a chance to speak their piece. I don't know if every single debate needs to have that same low threshold of letting anybody who's on the ballot appear. But it was kind of amusing. And as you said, definitely the amusement we needed heading into the weekend, because now we have the turd in the punch bowl candidate that America has been yearning for.
Jim, on that note, have a fabulous weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And have a great weekend. Be sure to join us on Monday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim, on that note, have a fabulous weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And have a great weekend. Be sure to join us on Monday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.